to Eat Drink Social. My name is Courtney Sandora, and throughout this podcast series, you'll be hearing from myself and the Go Social team. Go Social is a PR and social media marketing firm with offices in Denver, Colorado, and Louisville, Kentucky. We'll be discussing social media trends and influencer best practices in the food and beverage landscape. If you have any questions and want to reach out, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Go Social, or you can visit our website at goforthbesocial.com. We are joined today with Alex Connison, who is the VP of Marketing for Flaviar, and they are a company that does everything from sell spirits online to subscription kits and even whiskey advent calendars. So thanks so much for joining us today, Alex. We're looking forward to talking about the company itself and also learning a little bit more about affiliate marketing.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to chat with you.
So I guess just to start off, can you just give us a little overview of the company and how it works?
I can. I'll try to make it short. It's a complicated company in some ways that has really branched out into a lot of different business areas over the last 10 years. But so in short, Flaviar was started about 11 years ago, right after the crash in 08 and so forth, and was born out of the insight that it was really hard to try new spirits, both in terms of finding them and secondarily in terms of buying them, because most spirits aren't sold in sample sizes. And from that insight, this company was born that started as a way to deliver samples of spirits to consumers who want to try it. That evolved into membership clubs where, you know, people could sign up to receive samples on an ongoing basis. That expanded into clubs and memberships that also included full-size bottles. In 2016, Flaviar bought Caskers.com, which was is a straight-up e-com storefront for spirits, focusing on whiskey, but really across the across multiple categories. And you know, around that time, it started getting knocked on the door by a lot of the big suppliers like the Diageos, the Pernod Ricards, and so forth, saying, "Hey, you have these great audiences. You also are selling all of our products through the merchants in your network already. You know, we would love to advertise on your site, create programs with you." And, you know, from that, the B2B side of our business was born, which has now grown to encompass agency relationships with suppliers. We have a strategic partnership with RNDC, one of the largest distributors of wine and spirits in the U.S. We made acquisitions that have allowed us to create white label e-com solutions for really any kind of company. A month ago, we announced our acquisition of Wine Searcher, which is basically the Google, the worldwide Google of wine, spirits, and beer inventory and pricing. And we're working now with Shopify to create a payment app for their store that would allow them, Shopify powered stores, to compliantly sell alcohol in the U.S., which is not currently a possibility. So multiple areas of the business on the consumer and on the business side, but you know, that was sort of the story of how we got to where we are today.
That's really interesting. Yeah. You know, we work with a lot of whiskey brands and we always talk about brand loyalty and how really the whiskey consumer is very adventurous and likes to try a lot. So it makes a lot of sense that your business has been a success, but I guess, yeah. Who is your typical customer?
So he is, I say he, so I'm kind of giving the game away a little bit. We call him John. He is a man. He tends to be between, say, 35 and 55 years old, suburban, you know, not small town, not necessarily big city, but I think very suburban, may live near a big city, commute in for work, but probably not live in the city himself. He's quite married. He has kids. You know, travels some, has some hobbies, maybe plays golf. But, you know, basically work, family man. And what we sort of see is that a membership, for example, in Flaviar, or the really nice bottle of whiskey he buys on Caskers, is sort of his treat to himself, his indulgence, and one of the few areas of his life that he just does something that's purely for himself. So that's, I guess that's our center of gravity. That being said, of course, you know, we have quite a large audience. So it's more diverse than that. Of course, there are women. There's we have decent representation among other, non-Caucasian demographics, and it varies by product too. So, one of our most successful products is a holiday whiskey advent calendar that we do every year. Gets massive PR. We sell out every year, and that tends to be disproportionately brought by women as a gift to husbands, fathers, and so forth. So there is some variation by product, but that our suburban Caucasian John is kind of our center of gravity for our everyday user.
That makes sense. Yeah, I guess that kind of leads me to my next question. Is there a certain time of the year that you really see those gift subscriptions happening?
Yeah, so I mean, it largely tracks with what you see in the alc bev or at least spirits category, broadly speaking. So of course, holiday, Thanksgiving to Christmas is the number one sales period of the year. People buying for gifts, but also buying for parties they're hosting, parties they're going to. Father's Day is a pretty big gifting period as well, for whiskeys and subscriptions. One of the, I guess, so no big surprises there. Of course, alcohol is year round. So those are pulse points, but we see pretty consistent sales throughout the year. Obviously certain certain categories like gin or ready to drink spike a little more in the summer than in the winter. But I would say our shopper habits largely mirror what you see in the broader spirits category. There's relatively few places where you're like really meaningfully different from how shoppers are behaving otherwise.
That makes sense. Yeah, I had no idea you all had bought Caskers. That's interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, we don't. It's not a secret. We don't mind people knowing, but we do treat them very much as two separate brands. They do have somewhat unique, differentiated consumer bases as well. So, if you go to the website, it's just like, if you, Diageo doesn't necessarily tell everybody that Don Julio and Casamigos are both owned by Diageo, right? They let them exist as their own brands. We do much the same with Flavor and Caskers.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Whiskey obviously has been a hot category for a while now. Are there any trends that you all are seeing in terms of what's selling well on this site or just in general that you think are we should look out for in 2024?
I think so some of them would be obvious ones. I mean, bourbon is super hot. I think we see some emerging categories like American single malt is getting increased action on on in our stores, and I think that mirrors some of the heat you see around that developing category across across the market. I guess if I were to point you somewhere where maybe we're seeing some early signs of a trend that will emerge more broadly in another couple of years, is we do see some interest in trial of whiskeys, single malts or particularly, but from non-traditional whiskey producing countries. There's some great whiskeys made from like France, for example, but even more off the beaten path, there's actually some great whiskeys made from India. We've offered whiskeys from Asia, not only Japan. There's some, believe it or not, even from South America. We do see interest in, I think, trying these, what we call like whiskeys of the world. It's a place where our audience kind of self-selects a bit as being people particularly interested in trial and exploring new products. So, sometimes the trends we see don't really, aren't necessarily predictive of what the broader market's going to do. But quite often things that start with the explorers then trickle down to the broader a broader audience 1, 2, 3 years down the road. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is one that would, I think we've seen that in wine for sure, that interest in new geographies that start with a very small subset quickly spread across the broader drinking audience. Actually, wine from Sicily really leaps to mind as a great example of that. Like 10 years ago, impossible to find in most liquor stores. Now they're everywhere.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know when, the pandemic happened, any client we had that didn't have e-com definitely was scrambling and like you couldn't even get some of these e-com companies to call you back because they were so overwhelmed. And now that the dust has settled, I do know that, I've heard kind of across the board, and this is more on the brand side. Obviously, you all do this as a business, but they struggle, like the sales aren't always what they thought it would be because, and I think shipping's a huge barrier to that. So like how have you all overcome that barrier in the consumer's mind, in the Amazon world where we think we
Yeah,
see the
so
crime?
I guess I'll start by saying you might give us too much credit to say we have overcome it. I think we have partially overcome it, and we've made improvements. And I think that we compare quite well with the in the competitive space. But when you say, do we deliver the shipping experience that consumers trained in the Amazon world ideally want? Probably not. And I don't think really anybody, at least in the US market, does. So, I mean, you're right. Shipping is really tough. Ultimately, we're not a store. We don't own the inventory. We're a marketplace that facilitates shipments from regular retailers. It could be a retailer, your mom and pop down the store. It could be a big retailer to ship out alcohol compliantly within a state or across states, depending on the jurisdiction, to the consumer who's ordered it. As you can imagine, there are a ton of steps that go into that. So one, the order is placed on our site. That order is sent to a retailer. The retailer has to take the product, assuming they have it. If they don't, they need to order from the distributor. Once they get the product, someone at the store needs to put it in a box, print the shipping label, schedule a pickup with FedEx or UPS. FedEx or UPS has to come pick it up. It has to be, and then, put on the truck, delivered to the consumer. And then, of course, because it's alcohol, there needs to be someone who's 21 plus at home to sign for the package. So you can kind of imagine at every step along the way, there's time involved, and potential complexities because of the category we're dealing with. So, I think what we've been able to do is at least implement processes that make each of those steps as quick as it possibly can. And most importantly, probably create some sense of consistency for our consumers. So, does the consumer want it to take 5 days for their alcohol to arrive? Probably not. But at least, if we can say it'll usually arrive in 4 or 5 days, that's much better in some ways than it being sometimes 2, sometimes 10, sometimes 7, and so forth, where the consumer really has no idea what to expect at all. So I think we're always trying to improve on the operational side to shorten timing, to improve that consistency, to open up new retailers in our network. Because at the end of the day, that's the best way to shorten the time is by having retailers closer to the ultimate purchaser. Who's going to get it delivered to them to reduce the shipping times. But it's really tough. Obviously Drizly was unique for having built a model that was all in single day shipping. I don't know if you saw the news that Uber Eats, which acquired them, Drizly, for $1.1 billion during the pandemic, is
Yeah.
actually going to shutter the brand and try to migrate the business just into their general Uber Eats division at the end of March. And there's probably complicated reasons for that, which are beyond the scope of this convo. But without diving in, I do think that the Drizly same day ship model worked very well in certain large developed metro markets like New York, Boston, San Francisco, but is quite tough to scale outside of those big metro markets. And I don't know how far they would have been able to take that past what it already developed, to be totally honest.
But I would imagine on your subscription boxes, are they full-size bottles or are they smaller?
We do both. So we histor and we've had historically we've had subscriptions that are just tasting boxes, which are usually 350 ml vials that come in a nice little thematically organized, that come in a nice little box with tasting notes. We've also had subscriptions that are boxes, one box, one bottle. And we've had subscriptions that are totally flexible, where once a month or once a quarter, somebody can come on to flavier.com and, choose whether they want to take their shipment as a bottle or a box, and, basically have a large menu that they can make their selection from. And it's really sort of up to them to craft it how they want. So we're quite flexible on that.
Yeah, I would imagine I would be more forgiving if I knew it was like, a subscription fun box than, oh, I need this bottle, in 5 days.
Totally. And that was, and I think that investors that use our habit, right? I mean, we're not trying to develop same day shipping, because one, it's really expensive, it's really hard, and yes, of course, there are need states where somebody wants something right now. I think for most people, the simpler and cheapest option is always going to be to just walk down the street or hop in your car and drive over to the grocery store or liquor store for that. And there's a very large audience of people out there who buy alcohol not just for last minute occasions. And even among the, say, Drizly or Minibar audience, it's not that they're exclusively Drizly or Minibar users. They'll order their 3 olives vodka from Drizly for the party they're having that night, while placing an order on Flavier for Johnnie Walker Blue they're going to give as a gift to their dad for Father's Day. It's very need state and usage occasion based, rather than sort of like firm lines between platforms and consumers.
That makes sense. Yeah. So just shifting gears a little to affiliate marketing, why did you all choose to launch a program?
So we started an affiliate program back in 2015 for Flavier, and followed by Caskers shortly after our acquisition in 2020, partnering with Impact Radius. And I guess the motivations were both short term and long term. So in the short term, it could be a part of a paid media performance marketing mix that helps us drive sales on subscriptions, especially around key sales windows. It was helpful in building credibility with Google, optimizing search traffic and so forth. And then three, for the right types with the right types of outlets, there's equity value in it as well. When you have affiliate program with really nice content, that's informative and convincing, say in doing a wine or spirits drinker with, say, foodandwine.com. That's an outlet that has quite a lot of credibility. Even if people understand that it's ultimately a paid advertisement, the mere fact that it's like traditional print advertising, the mere fact that you're appearing there has equity value for the brand that has, difficult to measure, but like quite real long-term benefits to the brand. So I guess those were the motivations.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So how does the program work? Like, if do you seek out people or do they come in and apply?
Both we have it's a combo of, I guess, inbound and outbound lead generation and application. So on both our Flavier and Caskers website, there's a fairly easy to find partner with us section where an affiliate can find all the information about who we are, how we work with affiliates, can basically form template a contact information so we can get in touch with them, and from there quite easily join our network. We have a dedicated affiliate manager on our paid media team who's constantly scouting for cool publishers across the globe, focusing on the US, inviting them to become part of our network, especially where it can maybe open us up to new audiences that we're not currently reaching. And last but definitely not least, is in the Impact Marketplace itself. We're quite easy to find to make it very simple for publishers to join our program when they're on there and kind of looking for potential brands to hook up with.
So, do you focus for your affiliate partners? Are they primarily all publishers, publications versus individuals?
They not exclusively publications, but mostly publications, probably. I from like in terms of our Evergreen affiliate program, actually it probably is all publications. We do turn on individuals sometimes around specific products or campaigns. So for example, I'll bring up our Advent calendar campaign again. We did have a network of probably 8 to 12, I don't remember the exact number, 8 to 12 individuals who were, for all intents and purposes, part of an affiliate program, but working in like the TikTok, Instagram, social media space primarily, as well. But that's more on a case by case basis, particularly around major campaigns or gifting seasons, and not part of our, sort of like always on roster.
Okay, yes, 'cause I did see on your website that you also, had a link for influencers. So I was curious what the crossover there was.
So to be honest, Klaviyo has not historically had much of like a very active influencer program. I think it's an opportunity for us, for sure. Whether whether that's an influencer program we build through an affiliate model or an influencer program we build through a sort of more traditional paid or kind of organic program or some combination of the three remains to be seen. I started at Klaviyo about a year and a half ago, and that felt like one of the most evident opportunities for us to expand the mix beyond what we are currently doing, for a whole host of reasons. We've kind of just started dipping our toe in the water, though, and I wouldn't say we've have a really firm plan of if, how, and when we want to build that up.
Yeah, that makes sense. We work with a lot of influencers with brands, and it's just really fascinating. You try to guess who's going to drive the most sales, and 9 times out of 10, you're surprised, who it ends up being. And it's not always the folks with the biggest followers either. It's more about the engagement is what we found. So it's really interesting to see what actually even on the media side, we talk to clients and say, well, did you notice a big spike in sales after a certain article? And you think, one publication will drive that, and it ends up being a different one, a smaller one even sometimes. So, have you seen really good traction from like affiliate links? Like, is there a certain on the editorial side, is it like more effective than advertising or?
Yeah, great question. I'll start with the easier part first, which is taken on its own term. Yes, we've definitely seen success there. Give you an example. We have a fairly robust relationship with Dotdash Meredith around our advent calendar, and I keep bringing this up because probably the product that is has the most media mix touch points and highest budget, so it's sort of a learning and proving ground for a lot of tactics that we don't always use. I think the editorial that ran in foodandwine.com really drove a lot of traffic both last year, so 2022, and this most recent year, 2023. That being said, I actually thought the article that ran in 2023 was better than the run that ran in 2022, but the one that ran in 2022 generated significantly more traffic to the site than the one that ran this year. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Why? And the answer proved out to be pretty obvious, which was in 2022, the Food and Wine social media team on their own decided to also post on their Instagram a link back to the article and also a really nice image of the box. Whereas this year they did not. So, it's like, yes, it was affiliate. We got the editorial, which was what the ultimate commission was on both years. But the fact that one year they accompanied it with that social media post and one year they didn't made a huge impact on the bottom line results that we saw from it. And I think one of the balances we're also really always trying to strike is what I'd call, affiliates that have some equity value versus affiliates that are really just there to drive the sale. So the deal hunters, the discount sites, that kind of stuff to me is maybe helpful in a very short term for driving the sales, but is often kind of this price discounting by a different name. And I don't know what the value of those customers really are. Whereas some of the, more editorial forward publications sometimes don't drive the level of sales in the short term, but to me it's almost like a hybrid between paid media and PR, where just appearing in that publication, I believe, has value to be seen and get credibility with that audience. So how we balance that short term versus long term, the type of outlet it is, and the ultimately like the CPAs or what even metrics we want to look at is a constant sort of sort of debate. I come from a traditional brand marketing background, so I tend to push towards equity. This company historically was very performance marketing driven, though it's maybe starting to change. So I think the classic kind of brand versus performance marketer debates like happen pretty frequently.
No, that's really interesting. So I was a journalism major, and you're always taught separation of church and state, and you don't do paid. And I will tell you, just on the PR side, we're seeing more and more, especially with those gift guides, journalists requiring affiliate links. And there's a part of me as a PR person that's like, oh, that's like,
I
it's
know.
not.
It feels
Yeah.
dirty.
Yeah. But I mean,
No, it's
you
everywhere
either
though.
embrace it or not. Yeah.
I mean, and I guess I get it though, right? I guess in a world where the traditional advertising, especially print model, right, has largely died and no one's just buying straight up advertising. Like, if I own the magazine, I'd be doing that too. I mean, you gotta get money from somewhere.
Definitely. So I know we're close to time. I guess kind of the last thing, if you were a brand, a spirits brand, what's the best way to partner with Flaviar?
Oh man, that's a tough one. The best way. So, I think what works really well is if you're a brand that already has, there actually, can I answer, can I cheat and give you two answers? I am going to cheat and give you two answers.
Sure.
So the first one is I think it's a great place to launch a new brand because we can tap you into a fairly engaged, fairly large audience right off the bat. That, yes, helps you generate some sales, and ideally get some money in your pocket to fund future growth. But beyond that, gives you some success stories and data about, who's buying you, like the product actually sells at this price point, like all the questions that the distributor and the retailer is going to ask when, you walk in and present a new brand. They're like, oh, it's too expensive. You can say, oh, it's not. Look at this. It helps you overcome all those objections to go out and build distribution in the real world. So I think it's a great incubator for launch. And then I think secondarily, even for established brands, it's a great place. It's a great place to either reach new audiences, or to launch new items or limited editions within your portfolio. I think a lot of times this was a challenge I always faced because, like, working on big brands in wine and spirits. Is, you'd create these limited time offerings, which you'd spend a lot of time and money creating, and you would know they really only existed to get you PR, that the actual volume you sold from it probably wasn't going to make the money back that paid for, all the marketing time you put into it. A big brand can make those kind of bets sometimes, but it'd be nice if they actually had some commercial upside too. It's just really tough to go and get distribution on items that are kind of in and out for 90 days, limited inventory, and so forth. To me, Flavier is a great solution for that, which is, hey, go do your LTO, use it to get the PR you want to get, run your, advertising campaign, get the buzz out there. But now it's also really easy for anybody who sees that article to actually find the damn product and buy it by featuring it on a site like Flavier. And we can ensure it has distribution, really across the US and can probably arrive to most people within, a couple of days. So I guess that's my cheat answer since I gave you two.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a really great point. Well, thank you so much for sharing. This was really interesting. I appreciate you hopping on. Definitely eye-opening on how it works behind the scenes.
Yeah, fantastic, Courtney. Well, thank you so much for the invite. This was fun. I actually I don't get to sit down very often and just talk for 30 minutes about how we think about marketing a slave year. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. Take care.
Okie doke. You too.
All right, everybody, that wraps up today's episode of Eat Drink Social. Thanks for listening. If you have a story to share or know somebody that does, feel free to reach out to us.